that on crucial issues, the mainstream media here will almost always exactly reflect the views of the power structure. And only when that power structure is itself divided, seriously divided, about a particular issue, like, let us say, in the later stages of the Southeast Asian war, at that point, then the mainstream media may come to reflect those divisions, and it looks as though they're being oppositional, whereas in fact it's more that they're aligning themselves, or some of them are aligning themselves with one wing of the power structure, which is at odds with another wing. Alternative media flourish in the wastelands left by official media. If you look at the media during the Vietnam War, and the way in which, rather than simply close them down by strict and overt government censorship, people would approach the landlord and get the landlord to cancel the lease or to jack up the rent to an impossible point. News vendors would be harassed. During the McCarthy era, newsstands which carried The Guardian and other newspapers would be told not to do it. People in small towns who subscribed would get a visit from the FBI and be told that they were being disloyal by even subscribing to and reading this newspaper. It's quite extraordinary the lengths to which the power structure will go at a point at which it is decided that one of these small outlets, which has nothing like the circulation or audience of the major media, one of these small outlets is saying things which ought not to be said.
The American power structure, the establishment press, and the alternative press are the subjects of this edition of Alternative Views.
Today on Alternative Views, our guest is John Downing, professor of communications at the University of Texas. John is author of the book Radical Media and editor of Film and Politics and the Third World and Questioning the Media. Today we're going to discuss with John the difference between mainstream and alternative media in the United States, and we'll discuss ways that you can get various sources, alternative sources of information and entertainment in the U.S. and where the oppositional media are.
We use the term on alternative views a lot, establishment media and alternative media. These four words really have a lot of meaning behind them and imply a lot of things. What can you tell us about those two, establishment and alternative media?
I think establishment media are basically media which, in one way or another, subtly or not so subtly, represent the views of the establishment of the power structure of the society. Alternative media can take a variety of forms. I mean, the word is very loose. Alternative could mean an extreme rightist publication, like a KKK publication. It could mean something which is just different, like some golfing specialist magazine. It could mean some of the high-level secret briefing papers which are delivered to the president and the cabinet and nobody else is allowed to see. In my use and in terms of the work I've done, I've looked more at small-scale, grassroots, radical oppositional media. And those are the kind of media that I really know about, and I hope we can talk about some more.
John, let's give some examples of what mainstream or corporate media are, and then some examples of alternative. media. In terms of the press, wouldn't you say that papers like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, USA Today, and the Washington Post are sort of national newspapers, are the mainstream newspapers?
Sure, along with the networks and Fox and so on, yeah, absolutely.
And the news magazines Time and Newsweek.
Right, exactly. But if you're wanting alternative, then not all of them are national. But you could look at a whole variety of things. You could look at the alternative computer information network, PeaceNet. You could look at deep dish satellite television. You could look at alternative views. You could look at a whole variety of small video projects which are everywhere. You could look at papers like In These Times or Mother Jones. The list is endless. There's a huge number. There's even a thing called the Utney Reader, which is a digest of the alternative media, which gives you some sense of how many of them there are. But they're very often small-scale and underfinanced.
And the Utney Reader is now has a large distribution, something like 250,000, and it's supplanted Mother Jones as the most widely read of the alternative media.
Right.
Well, we talk about the establishment media and the establishment, the power structure. How do you see that in the United States? You use in your book the term ruling class and power structure. What are you describing?
I'm describing a relationship which is not quite as simple and blatant and overt as it used to be in the former Soviet Union, where the mainstream media there were very careful to accurately to reflect the views of the power structure at any one time. Here, the relationship is not quite so simple to grasp, but I think what it comes to in the end is that on crucial issues, the mainstream media here will almost always exactly reflect the views of the power structure. And only when that power structure is itself divided, seriously divided, about a particular issue, like, let us say, in the later stages of the Southeast Asian War, at that point, then the mainstream media may come to reflect those divisions, and it looks as though they're being oppositional, whereas in fact it's more that they're aligning themselves, or some of them are aligning themselves with one wing of the power structure, which is at odds with another wing.
Now, most Americans are not used to seeing or hearing such a thing as that. I mean, after all, we're a democracy and the people rule, right? There's no ruling class. In fact, I've had classes at the University of Texas where they say there's no such thing as a class structure. And when I was studying the U.S. power structure and the mass media, there was only one class in which any of this was taught. Only one on the whole campus for 11 years. And so people are not used to hearing this type of thing, and yet the ruling class itself is very much aware of its existence and function. Scotty Reston, you had a quote in your book. He talked about the intelligent minority, Francis.
Yes, well, I mean, in spite of the rhetoric, a lot of rhetoric about democracy in this country and some reality, there's also a large measure of hypocrisy. And people will talk very readily about how democratic this country is, that it is the most democratic country in the world. And I would that it were so, and I would that all countries were so democratic as this one is claimed to be. The fact remains that repeatedly, when it comes to the crunch on crucial issues, that democracy just is shorn away, and naked power is evident.
Let's turn now to the alternative press, or radical press, is the name of your book. And they, of course, are the dissenters. Now, there's a quote which you have, and I'd like for you to talk about this. You talk about the strict ceiling on significant dissent by the American power structure. Can you explain that a little bit further?
Well, I think that ceiling on significant dissent shows itself in two ways. That is to say, there are many alternative media which have operated, flourished, grown, died, resurrected even, without seeming interference by the power structure. But at points at which they seemed to be threatening the kind of the any kind of exposed nerve as defined by the power structure, at that point the amount of kind of repression directed against these small-scale media is really extraordinary. We tend to think of these media as being, well, maybe nothing much matters and they're pretty picayune and so on. The power structure tends not to share that view, oddly enough. And there are many examples. I mean, if you look at the kind of surveillance of black media in the United States during World War II, when they were the only media significantly raising the question of segregation in the armed forces, and they came within a whisker of all being closed down. If you look at the media during the Vietnam War and the way in which, rather than simply close them down by strict and overt government censorship, people would approach the landlord and get the landlord to cancel the lease or to jack up the rent to an impossible point. News vendors would be harassed. During the McCarthy era, newsstands which carried The Guardian and other newspapers would be told not to do it. People in small towns who subscribed would get a visit from the FBI and be told that they were being disloyal by even subscribing to and reading this newspaper. It's quite extraordinary the lengths to which the power structure will go at a point at which it is decided that one of these small outlets, which has nothing like the circulation or audience of the major media, one of these small outlets is saying things which ought not to be said.
I understand there are other examples like the FBI getting people fired from their jobs, even bombing or dynamiting presses, and getting particularly record companies to cease advertising in some of these underground newspapers, they were called then.
Well, we saw it recently with the Ice Cube track about the police and the LA riots. I mean, that was a classic case in point of...
Ice Cube?
What? It's a rap group that had a song about cop killing.
Oh, okay.
And
I thought that was a new magazine.
No, there was a lot of pressure to take that off of the market.
But, you know, with the alternative press today, I don't see that repression. Or is it going on? I don't realize. I don't see any interference in public access television. Or you're more... You're real familiar with the print media, and is this going on at all today? I am not aware of it, if it is.
Well,
it is with different groups, like political groups, activist groups like CISPES, for instance, or the Socialist Workers Party, but what about the alternative?
It depends what's going on. I mean, by and large, American politics have been relatively quiescent for the last dozen or so years, with the exception, I would say, of two major forces. One was the anti-nuclear movement, and the other one was various forms of particularly African-American struggle. But the problem is, I think, we can say, well, I don't think there's so much going on because you don't maybe get to hear about it. But this is a vast country. Very often the repression is directed against some relatively small group that doesn't have a national voice, some local community activity which doesn't have some national amplification. And so very often stuff is in fact going on that even those of us who are aware of these issues and read the stuff and watch the stuff and listen to the stuff don't actually get to hear about. So I'd be cautious about saying it's not happening.
There's a subtle way that a certain amount of repression of the alternative media took place during the Reagan and Bush years, and that is they upped the postal rates constantly so that it became more and more expensive to publish alternative publications, and so several went out of business simply because of this. John, let's talk about what a democratic society should be and what the role of the press in a democratic society should be. And actually, it seems to me that the Founding Fathers had at least a start in defining a genuinely democratic role for the media. You mentioned this in your book, Radical Media. How did the Founding Fathers conceive of the role of the media in a democratic society?
I don't think they were necessarily quite as democratic themselves as some of us are today, but the fact remains that in their time, they were certainly very radical by comparison with what was going on in the rest of the world. And I think they saw the media as, at their best, as providing a variety of views, at least some of the Founding Fathers did, a variety of views, the opportunity for free exchange of opinions about issues of the day, which would enable, hopefully, the best wisdom to emerge on how to tackle the problems of the day, given the fact there is no magical source of information about how to tackle the problems of the day. We have only our own resources, and so we need to exchange our views and even modify our views in that process of exchange.
And weren't the media also conceived by the Founding Fathers as a check against corruption and excessive power? That was an incredibly radical concept for the day, because previously the media had been tightly controlled by absolutist states, where the media were just simply not allowed, the press, mm-hmm. we're talking about mainly in print media, were not allowed to criticize the state, or they were subject to censorship, whereas the United States set up a Bill of Rights which gave freedom of the press, and there was actual discussion that this was the role of the press, was to attack corruption, was to criticize the state, to be a watchdog to the state. To what extent have the media in this society, and particularly today, really assumed that role, or have they become more sort of lapdogs of the state and a corporate power structure as opposed to, say, watchdogs?
I would say very little by way of watchdogs, unfortunately. The kind of cases that people typically quote saying for the power of the oppositional press are the attack on McCarthy in 1954, and Watergate. And the attack on McCarthy was indeed in 1954. He had been in full spate for 4 years at that point. And why they attacked him was he eventually went after the army, and indeed not just the army, but the military top brass. In terms of Nixon, it was, as I rightly recall, the Washington Post and public television, which were the only two media sources that in any way followed up the Watergate story until it had been right through an election and the other side of an election. Then, when it appeared that there was something in it, then you got the kind of the packed journalism syndrome where everybody launched in and you couldn't move without getting Watergate material. But that packed journalism is not my definition of an independent and stubborn press.
I think if I could clarify something, or try to, regarding the Founding Fathers. When we talk about the Founding Fathers, I always say, well, which group, who are the Founding Fathers? Because the people who were in the Continental Congress and signed the Declaration of Independence were not the same people who signed the Constitution. And the people who sat in secrecy in Philadelphia and devised this Constitution were not in favor of the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights, which brought us freedom of the press. This was forced upon them as a compromise after they brought out the Constitution. There was so much opposition in the country that a lot of books say that never, if there had been free and fair universal elections, it never would have passed. There was a lot of chicanery to get the Constitution passed. But they finally, by saying, okay, we'll let you pass the Bill of Rights and the first 10 amendments if you'll okay the Constitution, that did it. So it wasn't the Founding Fathers in Philadelphia who necessarily were for this. They were purely the good old white boy, mm-hmm. Rich establishment. And also the press itself. There were a lot of repressive laws at that time, which we don't have now, a lot of censorship and libel laws, which were quite restrictive then. So we've come a long way from the time of the Founding Fathers.
Well, they did pass the Alien and Sedition Laws right after, practically, the Bill of Rights was signed. That was basically a censorship law. So what happened when the radio and broadcasting first came on the scene? How was this conceptualized as supposedly serving the interests of a democratic society?
Well, initially, of course, there was a period of free for all, which included a period when frequencies were overlapping with each other, and some stations were much more powerful than others, would drown each other out, and so on. And that period of maybe temporary chaos was seized upon both here and also in Britain as an argument for a certain kind of regulation. And so at that point, regulation of the airways swung in. And in some sense, that ultimately, it took a while for it all to materialize, but that ultimately, the same laws of free competition, so-called, which applied to soap powder or shoes, were applied also to this public resource, which was the airwaves. And the laws of the market prevailed, and the result was that the airwaves became fairly quickly dominated by two and then three major networks. And that persisted until very recently, when now we have cable and the fourth network, I suppose, Fox. But I could talk more about the extent to which that is or isn't offering a plurality of views, if you want. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, what is evident in broadcast as well as the press media, print media, is the way that ownership is concentrated in major corporations for the most part. And so those influences which determine which kind of shoes and cars and airplanes and guns and bullets and bombs are produced are the same influences mm-hmm. which are very influential, are very operative in determining the kind of news we get, the kind of entertainment we get.
John, people like Ben Magdikian have written very good books about the concentration of ownership of the media and how the control is in fewer and fewer hands. But even if the control were not in fewer and fewer hands, if a lot of people own the media, they'd still be owned by capitalists and they'd be for-profit organizations. Would we see anything much different from what we see now, do you think?
Probably not, although sometimes it depends, of course, always how you define difference. I mean, let's take Fox, for example, which now has a lot of programs very popular with a younger audience. They're different. The Simpsons are different. Mm-hmm. But they're only different in the sense that the three main networks were once described recently, actually in the Wall Street Journal, as the bland leading the bland. And so to that extent, Fox is not bland, and in that sense, it's alternative. But if you stand back and say, well, never mind that it's alternative to the networks, does it really give a voice to those people who are habitually shut out of the media? Then, of course, the answer is no. It's just certain different formats, which are, you know, a change of the kaleidoscope in terms of entertainment.
Isn't the tragedy of the American system of media that from the very beginning we've had basically commercial media established in the United States, in Britain and almost every European country, and in most socialist countries and in third world countries, they had state-supported broadcasting, not necessarily state-controlled mm-hmm. broadcasting, but state-financed broadcasting, as in Europe, like in Holland and Britain, where you have public corporations that are independent of government set up to try to give broadcasting system that genuinely provides information, that provides a wide range of views and entertainment. At least that's the theory of European mm-hmm. media, and to some extent the practice of it. Whereas almost from the beginning we've had commercial corporate media that basically were geared to sell advertising mm-hmm. and thus to provide entertainment of the lowest common denominator to attract broad audiences, and that were owned and controlled by corporations that had their own agenda, that is a corporate agenda to strengthen the capitalist system, and that's the system of mainstream media that emerged in the United States, so that we've never really had any, particularly in the broadcasting sector, until public access TV, as we will soon see and as the audience is now seeing. But until then, it's basically just been the voices of corporate America mm-hmm. that you've heard on broadcasting.
Well, I think the problem is the definition of the airwaves has not looked at the airwaves as a resource like air or water, which are fundamental to any society's health and well-being, and so important that it is inappropriate to leave these simply to the imperatives of making money. A society deserves to have certain resources which cannot be simply contaminated by the logic of profit. And so that's one thing. The second thing is, of course, that typically over here people have assumed that if government is ever involved in media, it is automatically a tremendously constraining force. And I mean, we could have a whole program on this, but there have been so many variations of the forms of state involvement in broadcasting in Europe, from the Dutch system, where it has reflected for a long time the different religious traditions of that society, to the German tradition, whereby after World War II they very determinedly put control over broadcasting at province level instead of at national level in order to avoid any possibility of an overly strong central government arising and dominating the media system, to the British system, which has had a competitive channels, some state-owned and some commercial. I mean, there are whole varieties of ways of doing this, none of which need involve some kind of top-heavy government interference.
Right. In the various alternative media, there seem to be constant political turmoil in all of these, sometimes to the great detriment of these various publications or organizations. Is that endemic to the alternative press?
It's frequent, but I think political turmoil and clashes between people about political issues are pretty normal in political life. But in these media, I think sometimes, particularly in the 70s, in the late 60s and early 70s, I think it was particularly visible perhaps at that point, because people had sometimes a very, very sort of instantaneous and simple view of how democracy works. And they thought that by making a kind of like almost a mental religious decision, I mean, it wasn't a religious decision, but it was almost like a kind of religious decision saying, okay, we're not going to be hierarchical, we're not going to push each other around, we're going to do this as a democracy inside. And they thought that by making that mental resolution, almost like a New Year's resolution, that somehow everything would fall into place and there wouldn't be any hierarchy emerging. And in a sense, what they did was, there's a very interesting argument by a feminist called Jo Freeman called The Tyranny of Structurelessness, which is not exactly poetry, but it's an important piece of argument, because she says that by denying that there was structure, by denying that there was the possibility of hierarchy, people actually disarmed themselves from recognizing the tendency for some people to boss each other around, you know what I mean? And so people would say, no, I'm not being hierarchical, I'm just pursuing our common goals, or whatever, right? But I'm pursuing them better than you are. And so there were all the mechanisms that we tend to use on each other to establish a certain kind of ascendancy, which people were unable to name. The cat, you couldn't bell the cat, because you'd said, well, this doesn't happen, this is them, this is the power structure that behaves like this, we have decided not to, therefore we aren't. And I think that that was a major factor. Another one was that people were not reflective about one particular thing, and that is the practicalities of running one of these shows. I mean, you have to have some kind of practical business sense. I don't mean some advanced commercial accountancy sense, but some practical business sense about how to distribute a newspaper, how to get it printed, how to pay the printers, how to just get all that stuff organized. And very often that was a sign. The people who did that were regarded as the kind of the second tier people. These were the insignificant people, and the real sort of demons of progress were the journalists who talked and talked and talked and talked and talked while other people did. And that was a continuation of our kind of class assumptions brought into the organization of alternative media, which very often really threatened their survival from within.
There is an interesting point here, though. Despite all of the political repression of the alternative media, despite all the internal turmoil of the different organizations that ran the alternative media, still they were basically the investigative reporters of the last few decades who have scooped all of the significant stories of our era way before the mainstream media. Just some examples. It was first in the alternative press we learned the truth about Vietnam. We learned the truth about the Kennedy assassination, that the Warren Commission was questionable, there very well could have been a conspiracy. We learned the truth about Watergate. We learned about environmentalism, the problems of women, of race, of class, the Native American movement problems. All of these surfaced years before in the alternative media than in the mainstream media. And to this day, if you really want to be informed in this society, you have to be plugged into alternative media, because the mainstream continues to censor certain stories and simply not to give you the information. But despite all the drawbacks and the problems that the alternative media have had over the years, we should also give them praise for the vanguard role that they played in this society in providing genuine information. But if you were to tell your students or friends what alternative media you would recommend to get genuine information, what would you recommend?
Okay, in terms of print media, I would say The Weekly in These Times, The Upney Reader, which was mentioned earlier. I think that depending on your international interests, then things like the North American Congress on Latin America, Report on the Americas, which is a monthly. I think the MERIP, Middle East Research and Information Project report, which is, I think, is it monthly or quarterly? I can't remember these days, but anyway, that's real important on a very hot area of the world right now. And then there are probably locally, where depending where you live, there may well be some small radical newspaper that you can read there. I've been citing sources which are accessible nationally, but there may well be others locally which are real important.
What about those that keep up with the intelligence agencies, like Covert Action Information Bulletin, for instance?
Sure. I think it's amazing the amount of new and fresh information you can get out of a whole variety of these. And of course, there's a whole bunch of environmental publications and feminist publications as well these days, all of which are important to recognize and important to keep up with.
In fact, I think Alternative Views has compiled a list of alternative print media that's accessible to the public that you can write us and get a copy of. We'll give you that information at the end of the show that'll force you to keep watching.
Well, let's talk about public access TV. Mm-hmm. In your book, which was, printed in what, 83?
84.
Right. Public access TV hadn't been all that well developed, and you looked at it kind of with a jaundiced eye. Mm. What has it developed much now? Have you changed your mind about public access TV?
Yeah, I think I have. I think because there are now something like, I think it's over 300 public access channels in the United States.
About over 2,000 now.
It's over 2,000.
Yeah.
Well,
it's really grown. Yeah.
So it's a much more significant presence than it was then. Also, at that point, the only examples, really, Canada was something of a front runner in this in the late 60s and early 70s, but very often the net effect of public access in Canada was not all that impressive at the time. So that would partly account for my jaundiced attitude then. Today, I think it's real important because it is the one video source where alternative views, small and large, can be seen and can be heard. There are, of course, a couple of problems associated with it. I mean, one is that you have to be able to afford cable in order to receive it, and that immediately cuts out a bunch of people right there. And second of all, by the nature of the definition of public access, the time is shared with totally repugnant organizations like the Ku Klux Klan and others. And so it's a medium which is also open to those people who are actively seeking to repress a section of the population still further, even beyond the point at which they're repressed already. And so it's a flawed situation. But I still think that on balance, it's a very positive one.
It certainly has been able to obviate a lot of the problems of the alternative press, particularly the print media, because it solves the problem of distribution, access to equipment at a very low cost or generally for free. And even if we're lucky, we raise $5,000 a year, and yet we have a national distribution of our program, which goes maybe into 11 million or 12 million households.
it obviates the need for a big staff, which in turn eliminates those staff problems with which all the infighting and mm-hmm. I mean, Doug and I get along. I mean,
sure.
What the heck? We don't have to have those problems. Individuals can make their own stuff and put it mm-hmm. right on. You don't have to have the great expense or the time. But there does seem to be a problem now with public access TV, not including the fact that there are constant attacks on it at the local, state, and national levels, at the regulatory level, at the judicial level, and at the congressional level. But there does seem to be a problem with access that even George Stoney, who's considered the father of access at NYU in New York, has written about, and I see it here in Austin, and that is just the airwaves or the cable time is just being taken over by religious groups, mm-hmm. by people just doing nothing. And there's nothing of any real significance, acting silly, or nothing of real significance as far as the society goes. So this seems to be a problem too now.
Yeah, I think part of the problem has been, in a way, it's access has now grown to be a kind of a micro industry, at least in some places. I mean, now there are some access stations with budgets of seven figures for the first time. And so somehow in the process of all the fights with the town hall up and down the place, all the fights over one program out of maybe 5,000 offering whatever it might be, frontal nudity or some of the unacceptable words or whatever that gets some local citizens upset. In the process of all that, a lot of people have taken a very defensive line and a very overly professionalized line and have said, okay, we're just like the telephone company. We don't determine what goes out. We're simply a resource. And there's an element of truth in that, but there's also a very dangerous element of untruth in it, because I think it is the job of people in access to make very active outreach efforts to those communities historically underrepresented in the media, and to make sure that those communities know that they are welcome to learn how to use the stuff and how to fill up the airwaves and begin to communicate their concerns not only to each other and within their own community, but also to other communities that will, I'm sure, in many cases respond to the expression of those concerns. So
there's a certain responsibility, it seems to me, that public access TV has to compensate for the lack of democratic participation in the mainstream media, and that is that democracy is a dialogue. It's a debate with all the voices in society participating in discussion and expressing their needs, their problems, their views. And since the mainstream media cuts out so many groups, certain minorities, certain people of different political preferences, certain public interest groups, it seems to me that there's a responsibility for public access TV to ascertain what the needs are in their community, what the different groups are, what the different segments of the population are that don't usually get their voices articulated. On the other hand, it's the responsibility of people in those groups to take advantage mm-hmm. of access and to use it to articulate their views to the public. But it seems that all this needs to be discussed between the access center and the community. So there is a certain responsibility in public access to really make democracy work when it comes to the media. And probably far too few access centers take this democratic responsibility seriously, which is why I think you have the problem mm-hmm. of just getting overrun with garbage and missing some of the things that should be seen and heard in the community.
I couldn't agree more.
There's always one question in everybody's minds who do anything with either public access or with print media. Do you look to see how many copies are distributed, and you say 2,000 or 5,000 here, and they always tell public access people, well, nobody's watching. But is there a public awareness of the alternative press?
Well, I don't think there's a public awareness in the sense that if you took a national survey, that more than a tiny fraction of the population would be able to mention one single alternative medium. But at the same time, I think that would be a misleading index of the significance of these media. My example of choice is always that if you take a trip up to Boston Harbor and see the replica of the ship that they tossed the tea chests out of. It is minute by my standards. It doesn't look as though it could get more than about 5 miles offshore without maybe kind of being swamped by a wave. And the thought that something like that would have made the journey across the Atlantic repeatedly is hard to imagine. And I'm sure the chests of tea that they tossed overboard were also pretty small. They weren't giant kind of containers. The fact remains that the significance of that small action on that small boat in that small harbor kind of reverberated around America and helped to coalesce a whole movement of opposition to the repression which was coming from George III. Now, I think size, what I'm trying to get to, is that I think size alone, circulation alone, is not necessarily the only or the most significant index of importance, of impact. And I think that, you know, I spoke earlier about the way the power structure doesn't think that way about these small-scale media, but I think there are other indices. I mean, maybe the power structure could be wrong, but I think there are other indices, because when these media really become important around a particular issue, it is not just those people who read them, but those people who talk to others and others and others in a chain who will, in a sense, allow that information to mobilize them. Let me give you a very specific and recent example. There's an outfit called Public Data Access, and what they did was they got information from central government, federal government, and put it on floppy disks about the location of toxic waste dumps. And they found in the process of doing this that most toxic waste dumps are near ethnic minority communities, geographically speaking. And they put the information not on some national piece of some national document. They put it deliberately on local documents because it's in local areas that people are most likely to get up some kind of upset and some movement against the toxic waste dump. People in Austin are not going to demonstrate against the toxic waste dump in Montana, and vice versa. But the size and the localism of this particular piece of information don't give you any real measure of its potential impact, at least, at the level of a given community which is faced with this particular toxic waste dump, which is threatening the lives and health of the children and adults in the neighborhood. So size for me is not irrelevant, but it's only one index of significance.
How do you sort of appraise the role or the function of community radio in the alternative media spectrum?
Well, again, I'm glad you raised it, because it's quite right, it's the one medium we kind of left off to date. I think community radio is real important. I think that, again, the merit of radio is that it's cheap, it's accessible, therefore, to a lot of people without extensive resources. And I think that community radio has a major part to play, both in delivering news and also in playing, as we know, radio is thought of as purely music these days, but also in playing, you know, alternative rock and alternative music, which doesn't get on the main system.
In fact, you studied some alternative radio in Europe that's actually very radical. Mm-hmm. Some of it is low-power radio, where individuals just get a transformer out and shoot out whatever political messages or whatever music or talk they want to engage in. Can you give some examples of that sort of really radical radio that we really haven't seen anything quite like this in the U.S., as far as I know, at least?
Okay, the main examples from Europe are now perhaps, you know, sort of have gone by a bit in time. I mean, the key places were France and Italy. Initially, Italy. Both had a very strict law about who could broadcast. And basically what happened was that first in Italy and later in France, people just decided to break that law. They saw it as a ridiculous law, a law which simply gave the government of the day kind of free rein just to express its own views to the public. And so they capitalized on public discontent and broke the law in that situation. And eventually the law was seen to be an ass, in this regard at least, and was changed. But for a while, there really was an explosion of independent activity on the airwaves. And all kinds of groups would be involved in the social movements of the day, be they anti-nuclear or be they feminist movements or a particular community which was suffering a particular problem, or immigrants from the third world, immigrant workers from the third world. A variety of these interests could find voice on these radios, which otherwise the airways were totally closed to them.
Likewise, in Japan, there's some examples of low-power community radio. We have a friend, Tetsu Kogawa, who's specialized in this. And evidently in Japan, they got some very cheap low-power transmitters that basically just began a conversation in someone's home or maybe in a community center and would invite people to come and join in the participation in the discussion. And so a lot of people left their houses and actually became active participants in alternative media as opposed to passive recipients. This became so popular that Sony started to market these low-power transmitters. There were thousands of them all over Japan, and they were very, very popular, and this became a threat to the government of Japan that carefully controlled the mainstream media and didn't like these alternative media, which, needless to say, were very critical of the government and were articulating views that had never been heard before in Japanese society. So they cracked down on them pretty fiercely. So this is no more. I've heard some stories about low-power radio in the U.S. of this nature. Do you have any idea of the extent or what type there is? There's Pacifica Radio, which is a national alternative radio network, but what else is there in terms of alternative radio in the U.S.?
Well, I forget exactly how many stations there are. It certainly runs into quite a few hundred across the country. There's usually one at least in any major urban center, sometimes more. Here in Austin, of course, is KAZI fulfills that role. Pacifica is not a low-power station, of course. I mean, Pacifica stations broadcast on sort of regular wattage. Low power basically means that the signal won't usually go very far. And I remember Tetsuo Kogawa that you're referring to standing on the roof of the house that I lived in Brooklyn two or three years back and broadcasting to the house of another friend of mine two blocks away, Juan Flores. And we were then picked up by some other people in the neighborhood who phoned in and said, hey, what's going on? This is amazing. So it happens. And the transistor, I mean, I can show it since we have a screen. The transmitter is literally this big. I mean, about the size of a remote or something for your TV. It's real small. There's a lot of, I'm not a technologist or an engineer, but there's a lot of fetishization about how complicated some of this stuff is. And it really is not. You don't need a whole lot of wisdom or electronic engineering knowledge to be able to put one of these things together.
John, when we're talking about the future of media in this society, we need to begin to theorize computers, do we not? Because this is a powerful new source of information, and it's again something that is controlled by the corporate mainstream that can afford these expensive databases or these less expensive like CompuServe and some of the Dialogue, some of the other services. What is the realm of alternative media in the field of computers? Where do you get alternative information vis-a-vis computers, and how does this work?
Well, I mentioned earlier a couple of these outfits which have used one or other aspects of the power of the computer to communicate horizontally instead of vertically, PeaceNet and Public Data Access. And I think that the possibilities here are very considerable as simple microcomputers, personal computers, desk computers come down in price. For as long as they continue to allow us to use the telephone lines without putting some extra charge on, then at that point, communication by these means, it's like having a data telephone. And communication by these means is cheap, and it's very quick, and it's very easy. And so I think the opportunities there are considerable, and there is an enormous amount of activity today by the citizenry. On all kinds of bulletin boards and homemade databases of one kind or another. But again, as you say, if you want access to the heavy-duty information, and private information about corporations and the rest of it, then at that point, the same kind of privileged access to media and communications and information still operates on computer networks as in any other sphere. And that, again, is something which should be a battle for us to begin to try to democratize those sources of information.
And probably one of the most successful alternative sources of information is PeaceNet. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. PeaceNet was begun in California a few years back now, and its objective was to provide a network for peace activists in this country to communicate with each other, to exchange information about what was going on. It later brought in another network called EchoNet, as you see from the name, ecological concerns. And now it has numerous groups on every conceivable kind of political interest, which run their own bulletin boards, and it's real cheap. It's only a few dollars a month to join up, and you can be plugged in not only nationally but now also internationally, because it connects up with a whole lot of similar networks in Europe and Australia and elsewhere. So it's a very exciting new development, and essentially all it means is that instead of hitting a few keys and calling up the file on your computer which you put there yesterday, you hit some different keys and you call up a file which may be located thousands of miles away and have been created by somebody else, and you can access that and you can see it on the screen, and if you want to print it out, you can print it out.
I continue to get information about the Gulf from the PeaceNet database. Mm-hmm. During the Gulf War, every day I would get alternative information that was typed in from Australia, from the Middle East, from Britain, from different alternative sources that gave a very different picture of the Gulf War than the mainstream media, and likewise on environmental issues, on feminist issues, and all over the world, in China, in Russia, you have people in these bulletin boards putting information in that's very different than what you get from the newspapers. So I think this is a very important source of alternative information for the future from these computer databases.
I agree, and it's also a medium of exchange. It's not only receiving that useful information, but it's also being able to give information, it's being able to ask people questions, being able to request information, exchange views, and so on. So it's, in principle, a dialogic form of communication, which, as you were saying, is the core of democracy.
In fact, it's an alternative form of democratic forum,
right,
where people debate these different issues. During the Gulf War, there was a Mideast Gulf forum, mm-hmm, where people debated that issue. There's a Palestinian-Israeli forum where people give different opinions on this sort of thing. There was a presidential forum where people argued out the relative merits or demerits of Clinton, Perot, Bush, etc.
John, what is the future of radical media, particularly in relationship to society? In your book, you say that media communications is the fundamental element in the battle for power, and also power, culture, and communications are indissolubly linked. Those are pretty significant things, mm-hmm, to do with media, and particularly alternative media.
Well, I think I also say somewhere there that alternative media flourish in the wastelands left by official media. And I see, for as long as official media and mainstream and established media fail to fulfill the objectives that they are supposed by the sort of the law, L-O-R-E, of our nation to fulfill, as long as they don't fulfill those, alternative media will continue to flourish and they will continue to be extremely important. I think that the battle for power between the majority of the society and the minority, which thinks it has the right to run the society, is crucially waged in the field of communication. Because if the majority is dependent all the time on media run by and subservient to that minority, then our ability to know what each other thinks, to tap each other's wisdom, is going to be correspondingly constrained.
We've been talking about the alternative press. Let's take a sample of three news stories from the alternative press.
Recently, the city of Houston was granting all kinds of tax concessions and environmental concessions to a huge Taiwanese company which had gotten too dirty for Taiwan.
Oh my God.
So they were going to move to the U.S. because the Taiwanese feeling prosperous enough, didn't want the company there polluting their environment. It was a huge chemical processing firm. So we're going to increasingly become like third world nations ourselves, willing to prostitute our own nation and our own health just to have a company relocate to U.S. shores.
And here are just some totally unrelated facts from the November issue of Mother Jones. The average cost to taxpayers of one inmate's high security imprisonment for 40 years in Texas is $750,000. The average cost of an execution trial and appeal in Texas is $2.3 million. The rank of Iran, Iraq, Nigeria, and Texas in the number of executions of juvenile offenders is 1, 2, 3, and 4. That was Iran, Iraq, Nigeria, and Texas. The average annual child support payment in 1978 was $3,305. The payment now is $2,995. The percentage of Americans who think Republicans have a majority in Congress is 35%. And the percentage of U.S. households that did not purchase a book in 1991 was 60%.
People who are interested in foreign and domestic policy should look first to see where it all started out from. For foreign affairs, you should look at the Council on Foreign Relations. For domestic affairs, perhaps to the Brookings Institution or to the Committee for Economic Development. The Brookings Institution was a place where all the Great Society programs were hatched, which Johnson and LBJ later got credit for. The Council on Foreign Relations has study groups which determine what U.S. foreign policy should be into the future, and lo and behold, it always seems to work out that way. Well, you may not have heard much about the Committee for Economic Development, but it's the equivalent of the CFR, but only for domestic subjects. And here's a way that you can check to see how effective these elite organizations are. In 1962, the CED, the Committee for Economic Development, released a study called An Adaptive Program for Agriculture, and it called for moving one-third of the farm population out of farming within 5 years. There were just too many farmers, they said, and we wanted to turn it over to big agribusiness, our buddies. Now, the CED is heavily populated not only by elite members of the power structure, but also with people representing the big agribusiness organizations. So what the CED recommended was to immediately reduce price supports for wheat, cotton, rice, and other grains. Now, what has happened is that the U.S. policy has actually gone along and followed the general direction which the Committee for Economic Development desired. The government mandated farm prices steadily slip further and further below the cost of production, which forced farmers into bankruptcy. Since that time, it pushed 1.5 million farmers off of the land. Roughly 25% of the farms produced 80% of all farm products at that time. Now, displaced farmers, where did they go? Well, they poured into urban labor markets, depressing real wages, undermining labor unions, and which was another goal of the Committee for Economic Development. So things just don't happen. As FDR said, if something happens, you can bet your life it was planned that way.
And that's the end of this Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We'd like to thank our crew for helping our program today. Brian Lynch, Ashley Blake, and Jack Hopper were our crew for our interview. And Rosalind Peacock provided editing assistance. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. So that's our address if you'd like to write to us. Please do. Goodbye.